Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Project Zion podcast. This is your host, Brittany Mangelson, and I'm really excited about the conversation we're going to have today. It's going to be part of our No Filter series, which is where we talk about faith and sex and sexuality. And I'm not sure if I branded our conversation that way with our guests, so hopefully that's not a shock to you too. Hopefully that doesn't scare you off. But we have on Lisa Meyer and Aaron Kavanaugh. And this is kind of another, I wouldn't say necessarily follow-up, but kind of something in the same vein as when I interviewed Nancy Ross recently with her hashtag queer pastor. And I just kind of realized that we needed to have more representation from just different types of pastors and just different types of leadership, priesthood leadership in the church. So Lisa and Aaron, I'm not going to introduce you too much. I'd like you to do that yourselves. So take it away.
Okay. My name is Lisa Meyer, and I have been in the church for generations upon generations, but definitely went through some struggles when I came out. My family is like fifth generation or something silly like that. And then when I came out and met, or when I met Aaron and came out and we got together, we had a lot of struggles in the church. And for a while, we considered leaving the church. Tried out some other congregations of different denominations and weren't really happy there either, and came back and found our place and our niche, and it's really been a great trip so far, but I'm assuming we'll explore that a little more detail later.
I'm Aaron Kavanaugh. I converted to the church actually when I was in high school, and do ministry at our congregation, have done a lot of work with Gala, run some queer ministry in our home state right now. Try to do a lot of things, a lot of advocacy about social justice and feminism and just LGBT representation in the church.
And you are also, both of you, the parents to three kids.
Oh, right, yeah, that.
Yep. Yeah, well, which, and I only bring that up because we are recording early in the morning on a Friday morning because as three moms to each of us have three kids, you just kind of got to fit things in where you can. And I'm just really excited to have this conversation. So Aaron and Lisa, let's talk a little bit more about your background in the church. So I know that you two have very different stories. So I guess let's start with Lisa. And you said that you have a long generational history within the church. So I'm wondering what that looked like for you as you were coming out. I mean, how old were you when you came out, or did you understand? Well, and I guess first I would like to know how you identify as far as orientation and pronouns and things like that go.
My pronouns are she, her, and hers, and I identify as a lesbian. My coming out process was kind of tricky. I had been in the church for a long time. I was already doing ministry. I had a priesthood call. I was serving in the office of teacher. I went to Graceland for 4 years. I kind of did the whole church thing. Like that was a big part of my life. I was running a lot of youth ministries, probably more than the congregation I was in had ever seen before. And then I met Aaron and we fell in love, and that was tricky, really, really tricky. Coming out to my family, who's also in the church, coming out to the church leadership was tricky. There was a point in time when they kept taking things away from me, like different ministries that I was doing. They took it away. And then they asked me to give up my priesthood and said that if I didn't give it up, that I would be silenced. And so I turned over my card that day. That was actually at a church campground that I did that. So I either needed to break up with Aaron or turn in my priesthood. And so I chose to turn in my priesthood, not knowing what I know now. Like that didn't have to happen, but that's what I understood to be the thing. And then finally, there was a point where I said, okay, so you're telling me all these things that I can't do in the church. What can I do? You know, like I just wanted something because the church was such a huge part of my life. I said, what can I do in the church? And they said, oh, we have to get with the mission center president or region president at the time. And we need to know, you know, all these things. And finally, they came back to me, and they didn't come back to me. I kept coming back to them. and asking, you know, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? And they sat me down one day and they said, well, we decided that you can clean the church. And I said, well, I don't mind doing that. You know, I was doing that too, like that, but that just felt like such a downplay of the ministry that I had been doing before. It was really, really, really hurtful. But I stayed and I cleaned the church and, you know, we did the things we did because it was so important in our lives. And that was probably my biggest story related to coming out with the church. And I know Erin has another story that she typically shares that also applies to both of us, but I'll let her share that.
Yeah. Wow. I just want to comment, you know, the fact that you were doing ministry at camps and like different places with actual humans. And yeah. Then be told that, you know, your relational side of your ministry was no longer accepted and you were only good enough to clean the church. I mean, again, like not that that's a terrible ministry. You know, you said you were already doing it, but it seems significant that they took out that relationship aspect of ministry and said, here's your building, clean it. That's really, really awful.
Yeah, I was running our Young Peacemakers Club weekly. I was doing a Youth Venture for Christ monthly for teens. I was running a teen Bible study. I was doing all kinds of things with children and youth because that was a good fit for me. It was something that I was interested in, but also because I think sometimes in some congregations, if you're under 30, that's your job is youth because obviously you must know youth. So I kind of got pigeonholed in there, but I loved it and I did well with it. And then it was gone. And probably the saddest thing to me is that most of the ministries that I was doing died when they took me out of them. Like within a matter of 2 or 3 months, they were gone. And so those opportunities just weren't there for the children and youth anymore. And to see the congregation that we had attended go downhill so significantly, there was probably, on an average Sunday, there was probably 100 people, maybe 120 on big Sundays when I left. And now that same congregation that we no longer attend, but has probably 30 people. And that's such a huge drop in not that much time. It's really sad to me.
Wow.
It's hard to see so many of those youth too, like fall away from the church. Like they no longer had a place to be engaged because Sunday morning was a hard place for them to connect. And so a lot of them just fell away from the church and have no connection anymore because those ministries ended.
People that we're trying to bring back again now as mm-hmm. young adults and young families, that we're trying to bring them back into the ministries that we're doing now. But there was such a lapse there. Some of them probably never will.
Yeah. And some of them I've talked to recently and it's because the church really abandoned them. And there was queer youth in the youth group when that happened. They aren't able to heal those wounds because it's been twofold, like the ministry being torn away, churches being terrible to them. And I don't even know where to start in helping them to heal those wounds.
Yeah, that's so tragic. Just this idea that if you take out kind of the backbone of a really, really important ministry, keeping kids in, which is what Community of Christ's goal is, what a lot of denominations' goal is. I mean, you know, we need young people, but to have that just kind of fall apart as soon as a really important minister that's holding things together is forced to step away. Like, I can't think of much that's more tragic than that. That's really, really devastating. So, Erin, what about you? You said that you were a convert. So what did that conversion story look like and how did that impact when you came out and just that part of your story?
Yeah. So one of my best friends growing up, her grandma who was raising her was really, really involved in the church and she invited me to youth camps with her. So I started going to camps with her. I was raised Catholic. And when I went to my first camp, my dad had a lot of concerns because he was worried about me getting converted. And when I was there, there was a baptism that I witnessed and it was really scary for him. And so he said, you can't go back. That's scary. I'm worried about you like leaving the Catholic Church. So I didn't go back for a long time. And then when my parents got divorced, my mom's like, I don't care. Go to camp. This isn't bad. It's Jesus camp. And so went to camp and it was really transformative and it was a pivotal moment in my life. And to me really like turning my life in a direction where I was able to make healthier choices for myself, where I wasn't making healthy choices in high school at all times. And I kind of got my stuff like cleaned up and together. And it was a big fight. My dad really, really struggled with me converting to this church because he'd been raised Catholic, Irish Catholic. It was a huge piece of his identity and still is today, and really is an important piece of my identity. So when I left Catholicism, it was a breakdown in our relationship. There was a lot of pain, a lot of arguments, and I had to fight so hard to get into this church that when this church turned its back on me, I wasn't willing to quit. I was like, nah, I fought really hard to be here. And so you guys can try to kick me out, but I fought to get in here. So I'm not leaving. And that kept me here because I fought so hard and I felt God pull me into this church so strongly that I was like, I'm not leaving. Like, this is my home. This is where I belong. This is where I feel whole. And so that kept me here. And every time, like, we had some terrible things happen in our congregation in addition to what Lisa shared. And I kept coming back until they hurt us really, really bad one time. And that was the moment when I broke away and started going to other churches. And even when we went to churches, I never fled my soul. And so I kept searching and coming back to Community of Christ because I'm like, no, these aren't right. This isn't where I'm called to be. And so I kept coming back, if that makes sense. I think the story of what happened is important too. To tell. So we have three daughters and they're our everything. And when we stayed until we had kids and continued to fight in congregation life. Our congregation wasn't very supportive at any point in time. And we found Gala and they were really supportive to us. And Gala was actually the place that we were able to turn when we were starting to form our family. We were going through IVF and trying that whole process, which is just so emotionally draining. And we're able to go to a Gala retreat. And that Gala retreat was the first people we really told that we were doing this, had an administration, had our Gala family pray us through IVF and through the pregnancy, which was a really difficult pregnancy. Lisa was in the hospital a lot, kept getting dehydrated, super sick. So Gala held us through that. And they were our church home for a long time when we didn't have a church home. And then we did still go, though, to that congregation that was so hurtful to us until one Sunday we were having a pastor's election. And my daughter had been born at this point, and I went to talk to the pastor, the person who was, you know, putting his name forward for pastor. And I said, well, how do you feel about Lisa and I's relationship? And the conversation proceeded to be him going down this rabbit hole talking about how when our daughter had her baby blessing, there was people who didn't come because she was a daughter of, you know, two lesbians and that wasn't okay. And that there's people who don't think that we should even have a child and that she should exist and all of these terrible things. And it destroyed me. And I'm like, you can be mean to me all day and I'll sit here and take it. But when you are mean to my baby, who's just this tiny, sweet, like bundle of innocence, like not even a year old, I'm done. And that was when we left.
The mama bears came out, and we left. And we, I mean, we've never been back to that congregation regularly.
Mm-hmm. But we have family that still attend there. And that's really hard that they know what happened and that's still their home. That hurts. And we left and tried a bunch of other churches, which were terrible fits. And one of our friends at the time kept inviting us to this church out in the middle of the country. And I'm like, you're real pretty. And I think it's great that you think that this little country church is going to be welcoming to the queer folk. But like, we went to the city church and it was terrible. So I don't know why you think this church, like in a hayfield and a Christmas tree farm, is going to be welcoming. And I pushed back real hard because I'm like, I understand the country. I understand real life. That's not where I'm going. And she was very, very persistent. And we finally went there and they loved us back into wholeness. And that's where we're at now.
So did it take them some time to welcome you or was it just like an instant fit?
Instant, I think.
And I'm not sure if they welcomed us more because we were new blood and they knew we would do stuff or if it was because they really like understood the whole concept of welcoming LGBT folks. But either way, I think that they definitely were. They were so helpful. And after we moved, we had a situation where we got some threatening phone calls. And they prayed us through that and were very supportive through that. They were really good with us, really good to us.
I think the congregation in a whole, because when I've looked back at the history of the congregation that we're at now, they've had this pattern of taking in broken people for different reasons and loving them back into wholeness. And those people don't always stay, which is hard. But like, I've seen this pattern over and over again, where people come in that are really broken and they become whole and then they go on and do really cool ministry. And that's just like, and it's been different reasons of brokenness. Right now, our niche is the queer community, but they bring people to wholeness in a way that I've not seen in another congregation. And it's just really, really cool to see.
It is.
So I have a couple just clarifying questions. So as we're talking about your story, what year-ish are we talking about? Like when you two met and that whole thing?
2005 was the year that we started our relationship.
Okay, cool. I think that just gives a framework of where your story happened in relationship to National Conference and things like that. And then I know that we have talked about Gala a lot on the podcast, but can you just give us a quick idea of what Gala is?
So do you want what it is to us or what it is currently?
Or I guess, well, so we recently did a podcast on what it is currently with the current president and vice president, but maybe just go into a little bit more of how it supported you.
Okay. So Gala was a spiritual home for us. We, in the midst of all of this happening, my grandma got really sick and she was in Florida and we had to go down to Florida. We live in Michigan and help bring her back because she couldn't physically get back on her own. And so when we were on our way down there, we looked up to see if there was a welcoming church. And at the time there was two, that was back when WCN was in existence. There was two churches in the world, literally. One was in Australia and one was in Florida, an hour from my grandma's house. And so I'm like, well, I guess we're going to church in Florida. So we went to this congregation and it was the Clearwater congregation. And like finding that congregation, walking in, we felt so whole. They connected us to Gala. They invited us to our first Gala retreat. And that kind of just like laid the pathway to everything. We went to that retreat. They welcomed us in. They loved us. And they were our family. In so many ways when our family wasn't able to be there.
Yeah, I think that was really a godsend that the first Gala retreat was only like 5-hour drive from our house because they've been all over the country. Like that's one of the things is that they move around the country. And so the fact that it was close enough that we could get the time and the money and, you know, make that happen was really cool for our first one. And after that, we were hooked.
Yeah. And it became a huge part of our life. I was on the board in many capacities. I was involved with the writing of the book Touched by Grace. I helped facilitate the retreats, helped with conference planning, advocacy, and it encompassed so much of who we were for many, many years. And I'm so grateful for that and so grateful for those experiences.
And then Aaron, you eventually became president and Lisa, you were treasurer. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So just heavily, heavily involved. And like I said, we've had Aaron on before to talk about Gala and being president of Gala. And then we have recently had the new president of Harmony, which is the merged organization of WCN and Gala, on to talk about what they're doing now. But yeah, I just wanted to, you know, give them a little bit of a shout out again, because I know that they were so important in so many church members' lives. And so thank you. Thank you
for sharing. And they've even led into the ministry and the work that we're doing now, like in the church and outside of the church. We're leading non-religious based retreats right now in the state of Michigan. We're doing an annual LGBT family retreat. We're doing a support group in our community now. Once a month, we hold LGBT support groups and education. Our church for the first year was the host site. So we had the support groups and the education. All of them were held in our building. And we helped the church sponsor the retreat the first year. And so because of the work, too, that Gala did, like they've opened more doors and are continuing to do ministry in other ways they don't even know about.
Well, and we've also done a series of welcoming workshops around the state, and we're going to pick those back up again this next year to try to help congregations understand what LGBTQ means and how they can be involved and how they can show love.
Yeah, you're doing such important work, and it sounds like you've kind of patterned it after the model of Gala and the retreats, and workshops and things like that. So that's really, really, really important work, because I know, especially in your neck of the woods up in Michigan, it seems like there's really pockets of really accepting places and then pockets that struggle and that haven't encountered a lot of LGBTQ people, and or at least that they know of, and that they might not be aware of the particular issues that community faces at the hands of cis straight people. So cis straight church people, I should say, particularly.
One of the things that I really enjoyed was we were asked to go and present at a camp director's training on how to welcome LGBTQ kids and staff into camps. And that was a really neat experience that kind of was validating for us to know that we could help pave the way kind of for people who to not have as many struggles as we do. We did.
And it was fantastic, because as a result of that, we ended up having a trans youth at one of the camps that I worked at that summer. And the camp was so incredibly welcoming to her, completely affirming, made her mom feel safe leaving her there, like without her as a staff member at all. Like, it created safe camp experiences for this young lady.
And I'm sure that was so amazing to see, considering the background that you two had and knowing what feeling completely excluded feels like. And then to be able to turn around and be the one that welcomes a very vulnerable youth into the camping experience. I bet that was just a full circle experience that you had.
Yeah, it was.
It was incredible.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about National Conference. I'm curious to know how that played out from your perspective, like the timeline of where you were at with the church. Were you involved with that at all? Were you quietly watching? I mean, what did that experience look like for you?
So I was really involved. I had been in gala leadership throughout conference leading up to it, the conference before that. One of the big things that I had met with church leadership to talk about advocating for our community, how important inclusion was, and literally how it was saving lives, and we had to do this. And they've been really respectful and listened, was involved in planning services at conferences. And one of the big things that we did was the book. So the Touched by Grace book, we have this amazing lady here in Michigan. Her name is Sharon Gernot, and she took on this mission where she felt that she needed to give the Touched by Grace book to as many people as she could. She started with the Homosexual Saints and then moved to Touched by Grace. And she bought hundreds of these books, and we would just give them to people. So she would get a hold of me and say, Erin, I have another 100 books. I had money come in. I'm going to get books. And she would just purchase 100 books. And then we would go out to congregations and give them away. She would give them away. We gave them away at our local mission center floor conference. We had a booth there. And we just handed out these books and talked about the importance of the story. And the stories were what was so important. And I think just so critical in helping conference to happen, is people realizing that we're real people with feelings and families, and that we go through the same stuff that you do. That made it not a political issue. It made a human issue. And that was what I think made a difference.
So can you talk about those books a little bit more? Because I actually don't think that we've really talked about the books in, like, specifically on Project Zion before. So what did the books contain?
So there's two books, Homosexual Saints by Bill Russell, and then Touched by Grace, which the author on it is David Howard. And I'll go into that a little bit too. Bill Russell's book was the first book that came out that told the story of the LGBT community, told the story of how, like, welcoming or exclusion had happened in the church, has a literal historical narrative timeline in it that helps you to understand if you're not sure how those things happened. And then it just told the story of, like, people coming to the church, being excluded. And a lot of it was the pain, and that needed to be told. And it's this powerful story of the pain that people felt. And then Touched by Grace, we wanted to tell the story some more. We knew there was time for a second book. And in that book, it ended up being a lot of hope and healing and resiliency. And so it reflected, I think, the church's journey of, this was the pain of being LGBT and growing up in the church, and then this was our hope. and our hope for conference, our hope for everything, our hope for, you know, us in the future in the church. And that was the story. It was, and it didn't only include individuals. The first book was people's narratives in the church. The second book had a lot of personal narratives. Lisa and I's stories are both in there. But it also had congregations. So the Clearwater Church had a congregation story in there. Colorado, what's the name of that congregation? I'm sorry, you guys, if you listen to it, their congregation, their story in there, which is so incredibly powerful about how they went from being split to 100% supporting them becoming a welcoming congregation. And it was a book of hope and a book of coming to believing that these things could happen, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I just want to say that we will be sure to link the books and other podcasts. I mean, I've already mentioned a couple podcasts that we've done on this general topic, and I will be sure to link everything in the description in this episode. So if you're wondering, how do I get a book or how do I listen to more? I just want to make sure right now I say it'll all be there for you. Those books are really, really important. And I've read both of them, and Sharon has provided several boxes of books to the Salt Lake congregation, and we've given them out. And it's really impactful for people to hear stories that sound like their own, that they can see themselves in the eyes and stories and voice of another person. It's been very, very validating for people.
Yeah. Representation matters more than anyone can ever understand. Mm-hmm. And it's so huge. I don't know if you can link it to WCN, when the first book came out, Bill Russell's book, Homosexual Saints, they did a study guide. And a lot of congregations were even using that for, I say a lot, like tempered down, but like a lot of welcoming congregations and just queer safe places were using that as a Sunday school material or a meeting once a week and studying it. And they would read the stories and then it would have supporting resources to do in conjunction with it. And I believe it's a free downloadable PDF, but you'd have to check with Gayla to get that document.
Yeah, I will for sure. I have not seen that. So now I'm going to be on the hunt for it and we will link it as well.
It's a great resource.
Yeah.
So I did want to come back too and make sure I talked a little bit about, I said I would talk about the author in the second book.
Yes.
The author, as a board, we compiled the stories and we met at David Howard's house and read all of these narratives and edited them and compiled them. And it was such a labor of love. And in the process of compiling them, David Howard unexpectedly died.
Mm.
We were supposed to have a retreat on Friday and he had an aneurysm on the Wednesday before he was to fly out and passed away. And so as a result, we dedicated the book to him. And I don't think I can talk about, and you gave me a heads up, we were talking a little bit about conference on this podcast, and I kept thinking about David. And I don't think I can talk about those things without talking about him and all of the work that he did. And sitting on conference floor when it passed, I was so filled with excitement, but also so much sadness for the fact that David never saw that so many LGBT people who didn't make it to that day didn't get to see a day where their church welcomed them. And those were some of the things I think about too. Like it was so filled with joy when the resolution, when we passed, but also just so much heartache for those who didn't make it and for those who had left the church and would never know this change came and would never come back. So I think that's important to talk about.
I think it is too. And I think that it's really easy for us who didn't personally live through that and that exclusion, it's important for us to understand that our collective oppression against a community has lasting impact, and how tragic that people weren't able to see us get our act together, really. how tragic is it that through death or through stepping away, that wasn't realized, you know? So yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I think that it's really, really important to acknowledge. So thank you.
Yeah. I know that when I think back to conference, one of the first things, like I hugged my wife, obviously, but one of the first things I did was I found my friend Sandra on the conference floor. Mm. Like we hugged and we both were like, I know David knows this somewhere. So like, that's something I think important to think about too. Like that on the conference floor, LGBT people were also remembering the people who physically weren't there and thinking about those people also.
Which is probably a very different reaction than a lot of straight people had. You know, they were probably having their own personal reaction, and yet the LGBTQ community was also thinking about those who couldn't be there in one way or another. And I think that that's a really important distinction when we talk about the reaction to National Conference. I think that that's a really important distinction to bring up. So thank you.
Yeah. I think, and I don't know if this is a good time to segue into it. I think Lisa might be able to talk a little bit about her conference experience too, because there were so many emotions.
Yeah.
She had family who walked off the conference floor.
Wow. Yeah. I was just going to ask Lisa how your experience was. So
that was a struggle. Like, we loved being at conference. And one of the things that we had done, because we had little kids and we didn't have, you know, a lot of extra resources. And so we went and stayed kind of next door to my parents. And my parents have not historically been supportive, and still probably aren't the most supportive people, although we often don't talk about it. but we had little kids, and so we would switch off, you know, and these people would watch kids, and we'd be at the conference and all that. And so we were intimately involved with their conference experience too. And they were not in favor of the resolutions. And so we sat next to them, and it was really, it was a struggle. Like, I remember at one point my mom like went up to put her name in the queue, and I'm like, oh my gosh, what is she going to say? You know, like, what kinds of things is she going to share on the conference floor that's going to hurt? And so kind of like steeling myself up to be okay. And she really, I think she put herself at a 3. We were rating in numbers. Like, are you a 1, not supportive at all? Are you a 5, totally supportive? And are you in between or whatever? And they were kind of alternating off who was speaking. And I think she hooked herself in at like a 2 or a 3 and, you know, told a little bit of her story. And it was not as scary as I was afraid it was going to be, because she can be very outspoken about things that she believes strongly in. And one of the things, this is kind of a side note, but one of the things that I love so much about the conference is how much people were willing to dialogue. One of my favorite stories was a guy who stood up and he's like, I'm a 1 and I want to have lunch with a 5. Like, you know, like, I want to know, I want to hear your story, I want to see where you're at. And just the willingness to dialogue, which is not something we often see today in our world. I remember that story and I loved it. But when the votes did come down and it was clear that there was an overwhelming majority in support of all of these resolutions, my parents got up and said, okay, it's time to go. And they walked off the floor, and that was really hard. And of course their response was, well, we wanted to get out before all the traffic started. And, you know, like all the reasons that they could come up with to make their behavior more acceptable. But most of the people around us were not supportive. Not only them, but like other people from our mission center, because Michigan has a fairly conservative mission center in the church. And there were definitely a lot of people who were not supportive of LGBT ministry, not supportive of LGBT marriage. And that was really hard. And so again, we leaned on that Gala family that we had kind of created in our Gala community. And we really were able to kind of celebrate together, but there were not as many people as I thought would walk off, but more than I would have liked.
It hurt that it was our immediate family that walked off. And it was in sitting, because you sit in your geographical area at conference, and we had people there that were really supportive. Everyone wore rainbow lanyards, which was really powerful. Gala handed out free rainbow lanyards to everyone who came to our booth. And so you could look around and literally see rainbow lanyards across the conference. And there wasn't as many in our section. And I just remembered feeling like in my own section, it was like, tolerate the sinner, but I love you. And like, it just felt so gross sometimes sitting there. And I just kept coming back to like the places you come back to, those places you can hold on to get through it. And one of my favorite pictures of conference that year was the rainbow lanyard and a picture of Lisa breastfeeding her daughter on conference floor. And I was like, this is everything. This is why I stick with this church. Like, we're breastfeeding on the conference floor. We're wearing our rainbow lanyard. We're being lesbian parents and, you know, fighting the deconstruction of charitable things. And that got me through the pain and the hurt.
Well, that makes me cry. Just, I can't imagine what that feels like to essentially have a church be debating your worth, debating your value, debating your relationship, debating your family, debating your babies. And to be sitting in the midst of people that have this, well, we love you, but we still want to keep you and your family at an arm's length. And then to have it touch your immediate family, that's a lot to go through. And remind me, how long was conference? It was like a 3-day thing, right?
I think the national conference part was 3 days.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
World conference was backed up to it. So like there was the international conference part that lasted until I think Thursday, and then national conference started like Thursday afternoon or Friday morning and went like 2 more days.
Okay.
Those lines.
Yeah. So a huge decision in a short amount of time. I mean, that's a lot of high emotion. And to have that happen right after a long world conference. I mean, I know how long those get.
Exhausting.
And we worked the booth. Like I remember working the booth, yes. You know, working the gala booth through that. And it's such an experience, because trying to explain gala to people from all over the world and have merch, and people are so excited to take your merch and your swag, and trying to explain what your merch and swag is. And it was such an interesting experience trying to explain gala to church members from, you know, not our geographical area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Countries all over the place.
Yeah. Wow. And there was hope too in that. Like they were excited about the fact that we exist, and they had no idea.
Yeah.
Gala had a space on the floor. Also arguments. I had people come up to me and, you know, it was a world market, that's what it's called, right?
I think so.
And tell me that there's no reason that gala should be on the floor, that we should not be giving away flags, that that's an abomination. So you'd have these high moments of hope. And like, I can't wait for this to happen where I live. I can't wait for there to be a place for me to have acceptance. And, you know, in these places that it's not on the table yet. And then so have people come and tell me that I'm going to hell and I'm an abomination.
And Aaron talked about the rainbow lanyards that we handed out. But we also had people say, well, that's propaganda and you shouldn't be like trying to sway people's votes by handing out rainbow lanyards. And it was just interesting. And how the world church people, you know, like the church appointees shouldn't be wearing them because that means that they're trying to sway. Ugh. It was intense.
And I remember, I didn't even think about this until you just started talking, Lisa. I remember towards the end, Lisa's mom got really concerned that our lives were in danger by wearing the lanyards. And so she made us promise not to walk on the street to our car. We had to go through this. She made us promise to take the tunnel because she was scared, because there was protesters outside holding their signs and saying terrible things. And she was scared for us to take the street outside. There was one protester who broke into the conference chamber and started screaming things from the balcony. He had to be removed. And towards the end,
Westboro Baptist Church was there with all of their horrible signs. And
we bring our kids to conference, national conference, towards the end, the last day, because I was scared for their safety.
Wow. Wow. And again, that's something that I think a lot of straight people that were there were probably, you know, recognized that there were protesters and other denominations that were there and people in our own denomination that were super grumpy about it. But the safety aspect is something that's, you know, particularly on the LGBTQ person's mind at the forefront. So I just want to acknowledge that that's a lot of emotion to go through in just a short amount of time. So, yeah.
Ugh. Intense.
It was.
So, I mean, spoiler alert. Well, I guess Lisa already said, but the vote was overwhelmingly in support of LGBTQ marriage and ordination. So from there, what happened with you two in your congregational life? I mean, you know, I want to like get into what you're doing now and that kind of thing, but just walk us through that part of your story.
So one of the first things, I'm a little bit stubborn, and I told Lisa that I wouldn't marry her unless it was legal in my church or my state. And so we've been in church for a long time, but I'm like, I ain't doing this unless it's recognized somewhere. So as soon as that passed, I'm like, I guess we can set a date. And so we started planning our wedding. That was a big thing. Still wasn't legal in our state. But
so it was what they call a covenant commitment ceremony at that point from the church's perspective.
Mm-hmm. And so we planned our wedding, and irony, we did it in the oldest historic courthouse in the state of Michigan, is in our county. So we did a religious ceremony that was not legally recognized in a historic courthouse. I'm nothing but sarcastic and
contrary.
And it was amazing. And that was really cool. Lisa and I had ordinations processed for us. I was not a minister. Lisa began the process of getting her card back. Currently, both Lisa and I are in the office of elder. So that was, we were able to do ministry in a way that we'd never done it before. And that was huge. I remember at one point crying. I had done an intensive ministry training that they did in our state before this had happened. Where it was like 3 years, and it wasn't like Meads or seminary, but it was like a step down from that. And I would go 3 times a year and read these books that were like college-level books and study. And at one of them, we had an agape meal where we were serving, you know, bread and grape juice to each other. And I remember sobbing during that because I thought, this is the closest I'll ever get to serving communion. And I was ordained. And I really served communion to somebody, and I sobbed through it because I never thought that was something my church would let me do, even though I'd felt that calling in my soul so incredibly strongly. So those things, like those callings and those emotions, those things happened.
Being able to baptize our daughter, our oldest, that was a really cool experience.
Yeah. And she's like, I don't know what to do, Mom. I have two moms. How do I choose who's going to baptize me? And so we have a picture hanging in our congregation of Lisa and I walking her out together in the water. One of us baptized her and one of us helped hold her. And it made dreams come possible that I didn't think would ever happen.
Yeah. And so now, Lisa, you are the pastor of the is it the congregation that you first came to when you and Aaron got together, the little rural church, or is it a different congregation?
The country church. It's that.
Okay, church. Perfect. Yeah. So talk about that.
I'm the pastor at Otter Lake, and Aaron has taken her turn as well. We've kind of swapped back and forth, but it's been an amazing experience because that healing congregation has become a welcoming congregation, a healing congregation for lots of LGBTQ people and other people who have been disenfranchised by the congregations they attended. So it's really been a neat experience. We run all kinds of programming, even people who don't regularly attend or aren't members, like official members. It's neat to see people realize that there's somewhere in our community that is accepting of LGBTQ people. They may never come. They may never walk through the doors or even know where we're at. But to know that we exist makes a difference to them. Some of the stuff we've been doing with LaPierre Pride, we've brought us into connection with other people who are not necessarily churchy type people. Mm-hmm. But they've really been interested in seeing how, you know, what we do and how we run. And we've had community nights that we do monthly where we do different activities. Our one coming up is pancakes and PJs. So we're in our pajamas and having a pancake bar and inviting anybody who wants to come in. And we've had, on a Sunday, we have between 10 and 20 people. So not a huge Sunday congregation, but probably over the past year, we've had 100, 150 people who just come in and out to different things and come to this piece or that piece or, you know, call us about stuff. Or
and there's something profound. Like there's ministry that literally happens and just saying, yeah, my wife, the pastor, like in that statement, there's people that are like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. And it makes ministry happen outside of the four walls of the church, which is something that we embrace so strongly in any leadership and any ministry that we do, because church can't just happen in the four walls. And literally, we just had so many amazing experiences happen in a bar. We were doing an LGBT social event, and it was this pizza/brewery, and we were there, and I had somebody ask me to marry them. We had two people who asked about attending our church. We shared about some of the ministry that we were doing, and mm-hmm. and just it allows those things to happen, and it's been so cool.
And that wasn't even churchy, per se. It just happens. God brings situations that just happen, and they're amazing to watch.
And I'm always guarded even at those situations because I don't want to ever push religion on somebody. Like I'm over cautious because I know the damage that, you know, churches have done to the queer community. So like, it's really hard when someone's like, oh yeah, I'm looking for something. And I'm like, do I say something? I don't want to overstep. And so it's hard for me to even come out of my shell and do that sort of like sharing. And so I have to really get pushed, but it's been cool to see that happen.
And I think there's so much need in the LGBTQ community for community. Whether or not that community is in a religious, you know, vein or not, I think it's important for them to feel that. And oftentimes they're looking for something greater, like something spiritual, even if they're not. I mean, Christianity is too scary at the point that most people we meet are at. Like, Christianity is too scary. They've had too many bad experiences with churches. But the ability to come in and know that they're going to be accepted for who they are and know that they don't have to believe a certain way to be there and know that the roof isn't going to cave in when they walk through the door. You know, just those experiences are powerful for people, whether or not, like I said, they ever become full-fledged card-carrying members, you know, that they're able to know that there are people out there who care for them.
It's, our church is on a main highway out in the country where it's at. And so we've taken the opportunity of on our bulletin, like our, what is it called? The big marquee or whatever.
Yeah. The sign marquee.
And outside we have two rainbow flags that are on it. And it's, I don't know how many people see that and it means something to it, but I know that at least one person saw it and felt the need to stop and put a little passive aggressive note on our door. So I'm like, if I made somebody mad that they need to take their little notebook out and tell me all the things and all the scriptures, that means that I've inspired like six people. Like, I'm going to count this like both ways. So it gives us hope that we're, by even just having a rainbow flag on our sign.
We've put messages up like Happy Pride Month or God loves everyone, you know, just and more detailed kinds of things that I think have really made a difference. Like, people have said, oh, you're that church. And I don't know if that church is a good thing or a bad thing, but we're okay with being that church.
And we have on a huge sign, it's like, I don't know, 2.5 feet by a foot and a half, our welcoming statement. When you come in, it's right next to the bathroom. I'm like, everyone has to pee, so you're going to go by it. We have an inclusive bathroom, and it's right next to there. Everybody's welcome, regardless of anything. So we try to have in every aspect of our congregation people knowing that they're safe and really trying to do like trauma-informed ministry. I think being LGBT makes you have to do that because you're aware of how much trauma LGBT folks have experienced at the hand of quote unquote Christians.
So I think that you raise several really good points. And it reminded me a little bit of the ministry that we do here in Salt Lake. We have people who I assume will never step into our church, but they sure tell all their friends about our church. We've created a reputation for ourselves, and people know that if they have a friend that wants a community, they will tag a member of the pastorate team, they'll tag myself, or they'll get us in touch with people. And it's just really interesting to see, because sometimes, you know, for myself, I can look at our congregation and we fluctuate anywhere between 20 and 100 people, and you just never know what it's going to be. And so on the lighter days, it can feel frustrating because, you know, you've put all this work into a service or whatever it may be, but just knowing that we have a reputation in the neighborhood, we've made some people upset. Our rainbow flag has not always flown because of the hands of other people. And the fact that we are doing that and the fact that people know that we are a safe place reminds me on those days when our numbers are small that we're still making an impact and we've created a reputation for ourselves among the whole state of Utah pretty much. And people know and will connect us to people that are seeking. So it sounds like that's kind of a similar thing where people just know your existence, know that you're there, and that brings a sense of assurity. If they need a community, they know this place is safe, which I think is really significant for the LGBTQ community because for decades, your communities had to go underground. And so, you know, there's been such a collective coming out into just regular old society, exactly how it should be. And so I just really appreciate that they're in the middle of little town Michigan, you know, that there can be a little church off the highway that is loud and proud about being inclusive.
And it's really neat too, because like we are pulling people in. And part of the reason I think we sometimes don't have as many people at our Sunday services is because we have people who are driving sometimes an hour or over an hour to get to our congregation, and they don't always have the time or the ability, or, I mean, you have kids, you understand getting kids ready and getting them to a place is difficult, but that we're still their church home, even though, you know, they might not be able to make it every Sunday or even maybe most Sundays, but they know that we're there and they reach out when they need us and reach out when we need them. So,
yeah, I think it's important to talk about too, the fact that, poverty is a real thing that our community faces, especially our trans brothers and sisters. And sometimes they don't have the transportation to get out to our tiny church out, you know, in the middle of, you know, nowhere. And so that's something we have to be aware of. And we're always trying to fight too. So how do we help people get transportation? How do we help people when they're not able to meet their basic needs? And that's something that's been profound, where we've been able to a couple of times reach out through the funds of the church and help people literally, you know, meet basic needs that they couldn't otherwise do. Even though they can't make it to church on Sundays, they know that we're their home and we're able to help them to have safety in those things.
Yeah. Some people we've been able to transport. We have someone right now that we pick up from an adult foster care home that we transport, people in the congregation do. And then we've also been able to help people with gas money and that kind of thing to help them get to a place that's safe.
We had somebody who was volunteering to help somebody get to hormone therapy. So just all sorts of things that are real barriers. And sometimes ministry isn't about service. It's showing up and helping somebody get to their doctor's appointment.
Yeah. And I think that is one important thing to raise when we're talking as ministers, because a lot of times we define success with people in pews. And that's not what it is at all. If we can get somebody to a doctor's appointment, if we can get somebody to their job, if we can help somebody with a job interview, sometimes these basic needs are so much more important than where their physical body is on a Sunday morning. So,
right. And we're able to minister to them in more concrete ways in their lives than just talking about Jesus on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
I hope that speaks to what you wanted this podcast to be about the realness. And I think because we show up in real ways in other places, people come to us sometimes in ministry with the messiness of life. And it's, I'm in this relationship, I don't know how God's going to accept me when I'm not, you know, in a married, committed relationship. How do I find a place for me in church when I'm dating and maybe have had sex outside of marriage? And we get to have real conversations and help people with real issues because we're showing up real everywhere.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly, you know, when I think of the catchphrase in Community of Christ, Christ's mission, our mission. I mean, that's what it is. Christ wasn't necessarily building churches and putting people in pews. He would have been taking people to their doctor's appointments, and he would have been reassuring them that they had worth and that their relationship was worthy and good. And all the things that you've been talking about, I mean, that's where the hands and feet of Jesus really come to life. So good stuff. So I am curious a little bit, since you've had such a roller coaster with the Michigan area, how has, I mean, both of you have been pastor of your congregation. So how has that been accepted by the larger mission center?
I feel like we've been really, really accepted by the mission center leadership, particularly in the last probably 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. But originally, like when we were attending the other congregation, we sat down with mission center leadership and asked them, you know, where can we go that's more accepting? And they're basically like, nowhere, like this is your option. And so it's been an ongoing struggle and an evolutionary kind of thing to be where we're at now. But I think that some of our current leadership is very supportive. In fact, I know that they are. And they've been really helpful in helping us do ministry to bring other congregations along. As for other congregations, they've not always welcomed us quite as much as I would like to see. I think we're well known. I know that at least.
We're notorious.
We're notorious. That's probably a better word. And they know if we come in that we're not going to come in gentle and hiding who we are and kind of filling that status quo. That's not what we're here to do. So
we don't have the conversations anymore. There was a time where people would have the conversations about, well, do you have to flaunt it? Do you have to show it? And I'm like, I don't know if it's flaunting it to hold my wife's hand. Because I don't feel like it's flaunting it when my cis friends hold their spouse's hands. And those things have stopped. We don't hear those as much anymore. I wish everybody in podcast land could see your face when I said that out loud, because that was the best. You're like, excuse me, they say what? But yeah, and we do still get those from other people, but we don't hear that in the church anymore. I think we've gotten to the place where people know better than to sometimes say those things to us because we are a fierce advocate. And we'll stand up and people know they can call us and we're going to help advocate for you if you need it. And we're going to help advocate for the community and just for social justice in general, no matter what it is, we'll stand up and fight that. And we've had congregations in, you know, the far north invite us to do LGBT research, workshops, Northern Michigan conservative. So people that don't know Michigan. And then we've also had congregations in the city invite us to do them. And so that's been reassuring to be able to hold workshops and have people come to be, invited to do leadership at youth camps now and to be in a room, as camp staff. That's huge. And that's something that never would have happened before. Like, no, you like girls, you can't staff a youth camp. And people are like, nope, that's dumb. You're welcome to staff our camps now. And so you just see these shifts happening that are so incredibly cool. The fact that I can do prayer at Mission Center Conference, that I could serve. I was just elected to a board for one of our campgrounds. And so like we're showing up in ministry again in a larger area. And sometimes it's hard to know how to handle that because for so long I was, when you've had trauma happen to you, you become guarded and you become hypervigilant when you look over your shoulder. And for so long before the resolution passed and even in the implementation of it, there was that guarded to protect ourselves. And I feel like it's starting to come down and I'm starting to feel safe again.
I mean, there were definitely meetings in our mission center, even after national conference, where they basically said, because the policy was first, I don't think that many people realized that the policy was put out in kind of a trial basis. And, there were a lot of people in Michigan who are like, well, when it fails, you know, we'll go back to the way it used to be kind of thing. And that was really interesting to hear that because I nobody knew that it was trial. And I don't know that anyone anticipated that it would continue to be trial, but obviously there were people in Michigan who were holding on to it because we went to mission center meetings and congregation group meetings where they're like, well, you know, after they realize that this isn't going to work, then we'll go back to, and I'm like, I don't know that you know that that's really not how I anticipate this is going to play out.
Wow. My face has made some faces as you two have been talking because, I mean, I cannot understand why someone would think that their comment or saying like, well, when this fails, or do you have to hold your wife's hand? I mean, you two are committed. You have three children together. You have very intentionally had those three children with more intention than a lot of straight couples have when they have kids.
And there's people who really feel like that we're shoving our agenda, quote unquote, in their face by like existing and like being affectionate. And I don't think they understand all the components of being affectionate. Like, it is scary sometimes. Like a lot of times I don't have to think about it and I can just hold Lisa's hand because I love her and I just want to, you know, show that. But there's also times that you think about all of the components. And like Lisa said, when we first moved to where we're living now, it's a rural area. And we had neighbors call my phone and multiple times threaten physical and sexual violence to me, Lisa, and Kennedy when she was a baby. And so wow. The things that go through our head, like that makes it scary to even show up and, you know, be ourselves in any place. And I don't think people realize that. Like, those are the things you carry with you when you're queer all the time.
Waking up in the morning and wondering if there's going to be, like, a cross on your lawn burning. Like, those kinds of things happen still. And they happen to people like us still. And it's concerning. Like, we had an alarm system. We have dogs. We got an extra dog. We have three dogs now. You know, dogs that are protective and that anything we can do to protect ourselves. We're also anti-gun pretty much for the most part. So we don't want to go down that route, but having some kind of protection can be important.
Yeah. And I think that's a message that people need to hear. I think that the world that we have created is still hostile. And no matter how much progress we can pat ourselves on the back for, there's still microaggressions and then just outright threats that are a regular part of an LGBTQ person's daily existence. So I'm really, really sorry that is the reality, but it is important to talk about.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't understand microaggressions. And that would be an amazing thing to see a future podcast on, because I think people don't even know what that term is when you don't live in a minority group or understand what it's like all day.
Yeah, the whole, I was just joking around. Well, but it wasn't though. It wasn't a joke, because there was something serious in that. There's always a piece of seriousness in every kind of joke like that.
Or you can only get stung so many times before it's a big deal.
And you put up your walls quicker, and it takes more work to get those walls down. Like, there are times when I'm like, I just can't leave the house today. Like, I know this is a safe place and I need to be here. I can't be out in the world today. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen.
Yeah.
Happens less than it used to.
Well, and with this conversation, I guess this is where it's good to bring up representation and visibility, but also with the understanding that it's obviously really, really complex. So the fact that you two have both been pastors, you're both elders in Community of Christ, can you talk from your perspective of why it's important for the LGBTQ community to have visibility, for teens and kids to be able to see people like them in leadership positions, to working moms, you have a family? I mean, what impact do you think that has on kids? And what would that have meant to you when you were growing up?
I mean, I think it's super important. And I'm going to use an example of our oldest daughter going to kindergarten. We were stressed, really, really stressed, because we live in a very conservative community. And we didn't know how she would be taken. We didn't know how, you know, other parents would treat her, or, you know, if she would be able to have friends. And we very coherently and decided to make ourselves a presence in the classroom and make ourselves a presence with the teachers. And, you know, and now, I mean, I think probably everyone in the school knows that our kids have two moms, and they're kind of jealous. They're jealous that our kids have two moms
Let me tell the Harper story. Okay. It's my favorite story. So one of our middle child's, one of her really good friends, her mom was telling me that she came downstairs, she'd been laying under her blankets and she'd fallen asleep on the couch, and her daughter came downstairs sobbing, "I don't know where my mom is. It's not fair. Addie has two moms and I can't even find my one." And so it's like, it is. It's literally like, it's not fair. You get two and I only get one mom. So yeah, it's really cool. And the school is super safe and welcoming. And it's, we're still always on guard, and we do extra work of, we volunteer at the school, and we did from the get go. Like, we would volunteer, on the parent committees. We run Girl Scouts because I wanted to make sure that we were there to be able to be that leadership and make sure there was safety. And I know that through that representation, I think representation happens at church and outside of church. So it's okay that I'm talking about both. It means it's real for other people. When I had somebody who had recently moved to the county and they were asking about getting married. And so they're like, well, where can I go? Like, is the clerk going to give me a hard time? What do I need to watch for? How do I keep myself safe? And we're able to mentor through that process. Lisa and I were the first couple to do a second parent adoption in our county. So even though we intentionally had our girls, I had no legal rights to them when they were born. And didn't until our marriage had been legally recognized for a year. And then we had to spend thousands of dollars and go through all these paperworks and all these hoops so that I could legally second parent adopt all three of my girls.
Have a visit from a court. A home visit to make sure their house was
safe. We had a social worker come out and visit us. I had to have a doctor certified that I wasn't dying of anything. Just so I could legally adopt my girls. But then at the school, I could legally sign paperwork. That was huge. I could take my kid to the doctor if she was sick, instead of having to make sure Lisa was home to take them, because I don't have legal rights and I can't sign for an antibiotic. Like,
or if anything ever happened to me, God forbid, that we would not, that you would not get them. Like, why would they not stay with their parent?
So it offers security to other couples, I think, that this is real and this is something that can happen. I know one of our really good friends that's a gay male couple, that one of the youth that came to their wedding, she'll share that she sobbed through it because that meant that she could get married. And it was the first time she saw a same-sex couple get married and how profound that was. That, like, it's not just something you see on, you know, on Ellen or on, you know, whatever. This is real life and, like, real life messy.
And I think too, it was like, there was a friend of ours that came to our wedding, and it was the first wedding she brought her daughter to, and her daughter came home and was having, you know, her two girl dolls, like, marry each other. And she's like, that was just so neat to see that if that's something that she wants to do in the future, she knows that that's real, that that happens. So representation definitely matters. It's an important thing to know.
Yeah. And I think it makes our kids think about things in all areas. So, like, yeah, the kids in my daughter's friends group think about LGBT issues and how this is important for Kennedy's moms to be safe. But then it goes to other things too. So they think about, how is this going to impact this kid who might look different than me or have a different religion than me? So it just makes our kids and our communities more aware in lots of areas.
Better people, even people with disabilities. Like, they're just more open. They understand. They're better than kids were when I was young. I don't know. I appreciate it.
And I guess we see that in our congregation too, because we have several people that are active in our congregation that identify as atheist, but they wanted to be connected to a spiritual home, like, which is confusing and convoluted, and they wanted to be connected to us. And so you make things available when you live outside of the box.
Mm-hmm. And really, sometimes I think people just need to know that we're really just boring. Like, we're not out there at clubs all the time and doing all the crazy, you know, multiple partner, whatever. We're really just boring. Like, we're two moms raising three kids, going to school, going to church, doing all the things, you know. We're no more exciting than anyone else.
Yeah, just give us some naps and coffee. And
we're not exotic and unusual and strange. I mean, we're kind of strange, but no different than anyone else.
It reminds me of, there was a meme that went around for a while. It was like two gay men talking about their gay life. And they're like, and then I had my gay coffee and I read my gay newspaper and I put on my gay slippers. And, you know, it's just like, here I am living the homosexual life that's so threatening to everybody else. Like, me and my gay slippers.
I've taken it down a fun path where I enjoy, at this point, ridiculous stereotypes, and I have a life goal of owning a Subaru one day.
Ooh, that, they're great cars. So
and they are stereotypically lesbian cars. Sorry, everybody who's straight has Subaru. And I have hordes of Birkenstocks and plaid that I wear just to mess with people sometimes.
Perfect. Well, I have openly said that I just feel like lesbians have figured out the secret to the world. Like, they've cracked it. I mean, they just win all the things. So flannel shirts are great.
I mean, Birkenstocks are where it's at.
Yeah, they're very comfortable shoes. And you know, I have to just state this, because as you were talking and how important it is to be represented, how much work that is on you. I mean, listening to all of the volunteering that you've done. I mean, I am in a very privileged place because I don't feel like I need to be represented in my kids' school. I mean, I guess that we are the only members of Community of Christ and probably one of the only non-Mormons in the school, but I don't feel like I need to show up to prove that I'm just like everybody else. And so that representation, I just want to acknowledge that it's a lot of work. And the fact that you feel like you need to be represented because somehow your existence is still not the norm is kind of unfortunate, that you have to do more work to just prove that your family is worth the family next door. And, you know, am I making sense? Like, it's just,
you are.
It's frustrating.
Yeah. And it's rewarding too, though. Like, it would be nice to not have to put all that in, but it was also kind of nice to walk down the hallway this morning after talking to our kids' teacher for, you know, about a thing and have, like, probably, I don't know, 15 kids in the school just come up to us and hug us and be like, oh, you're here today. You know, people that we don't, that our friend, our kids' friends, but some people that weren't even our kids' friends that just know who we are and know that we're safe. And that's neat too.
Yeah.
So putting in the work is also rewarding.
Yeah. It is. But I think it's hard too, though, because then when we mess up, I think this happens for all parents though. I feel that load even harder. Yeah. And there's been times that we have, like, I didn't think about doing last year extra support to teachers about Father's Day. Cause we've had a couple of teachers that have been so good at dealing with holidays that our kids don't fit, you know, the norm of. And then last year we had come home 3 Father's Day projects for my middle daughter, where one father was just whited out and uncle was written next to it in Sharpie. Like, there was a big like gap and then uncle. Like, she didn't even write over the whited out part. The other one, she just had them spell father, like one of those, what is it called?
Acrostics, where they F-A-T-H down the side and then they wrote something that described their father. So she did that and she said, I did it for Uncle Eric, Mom, but
I'm like, do you feel like it's weird that you wrote father for your Uncle Eric? Maybe we could have wrote uncle. And she's like, yeah, it was weird. It made me sad. And like, and she, then we had to talk about it. So now we have a recurring reminder in our calendar every year, 2 weeks before Father's Day, to go talk to the teachers so we can give them support. Like, this is how you get through Father's Day.
You know, our family trees, the pre-done family trees that have the spot for the father. And it just makes our kids feel different. And that's a struggle sometimes too. And I think our oldest is starting to kind of like take it on as a personal challenge. So like, she's taking on the advocacy role, but our middle is still young and shy and working that out. So it's tricky and they shouldn't have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at this point, how old are your girls?
10, 7, and 4.
Nice. Fun ages.
Kindergarten. Next year we'll have our youngest in kindergarten and all 3 will be in school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our oldest goes to middle school, which is a totally new experience. Like, we don't have any connections in the middle school yet. So we're going to have to work to make those connections.
It's been incredible to have a church a family though, that holds us when we have these things, and they'll be sad with us. They'll be angry with us when we had those calls that happened. And I was beside myself. They did. They literally came and prayed with me and would be with us like anytime we needed it. I could call them and they would be there. And that's been huge.
Yeah.
To not have to fight it by ourselves.
Yeah.
So have somebody to celebrate the good with. So they're there in the good and the bad. And that's what church and family is about.
So I guess one of my last questions, and then I like to just say, is there anything else that you didn't get to say? But first, before we get to that, I'm curious to hear what your hopes are for the church, and by the church I mean Community of Christ, where you see there's room for growth, that kind of thing. What are your thoughts on the future of Community of Christ?
I think that there's a lot of growth to be done in congregations. It's hard when someone reaches out to me and says, you know, I'm looking for a safe space in my community, and I can't just say Community of Christ is, because it isn't always. Sometimes it's more harmful than good. And bringing someone from the LGBTQ community into a congregational space, the last thing you want is to bring them into a space that's not going to accept them, because they've already had so many spaces that haven't accepted them. I mean, it really, not to be dramatic, but it can be fatal. Like, it can really cause trouble for people who are rejected again. And so it would be nice, really nice, if I could say to someone on the other side of the state who's looking for a church, you can go to Community of Christ and it will be safe. That's where I'd like to be in the future.
I agree with that. And I'd like to see, I see more representation happening. I see gay and lesbian people in leadership at different levels, but I still don't see gender nonconforming individuals, non-binary individuals, trans folk. I don't see all members of our community being represented. I see white, gay, and lesbians being represented. And we need, that would be what I would hope for in the future, is seeing the full diversity of our community being uplifted into leadership and in other ways.
That's a really, really important goal to have. And I hope that we're getting there. I hope that as we allow our young folks to be who they are unapologetically, that that will start happening. Because I know that I know several trans folks and non-binary folks in the church, and they bring brilliant ministry. And so I hope that as time goes on, and I don't mean that in like long-term goal, I mean soon, I hope that we can start seeing more representation at different levels of leadership, because it's really important. And like we've talked about, the representation and just the visibility of being able to see somebody like yourself is really, really important, especially for the most marginalized groups.
Thank you so much for having us on, Brittany.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you'd like to say that you weren't able to, or?
Can't really think of anything brilliant.
I mean, it doesn't need to be brilliant.
A very articulate closing comment, but I don't know that I do.
No, but there's always more to be said, and there's always more to be to learn. And I think just keep that, you know, inquisitive nature about yourself and keep seeking to find out more information, and don't be scared that you're going to have the wrong answer, because you're going to have the wrong answer, because things change and we mess up. And I can tell lots of stories where I've messed up. And so just boldly, you know, try to learn and mess up and do better every day.
And I guess ultimately I did think of something kind of articulate, just to never be certain that you have it right. And I think it's really just good life advice, because there's always so much more to learn, and there's always so much more to change your mind. And God didn't give us brains so that we could close them and never take in any new input. Like, there's constantly new input to learn, and make it a priority to learn from people different than you. Make a priority to be that person who says, I'm a one who wants to lunch with a five. Like, that's important. It's important that you take the opportunity to learn, because you're not always right. I'm not even always right. Whoa.
Yeah. It's a hard pill to swallow. Also, the looks you two are giving each other. Giving me life. True spouses. It's great. All right. Well, I am so glad that we were able to make this work. I'm really glad that we had this conversation.
Me too.
Thank you so much, Brittany.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.